You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more than a million asylum claims are waiting for a ruling from U.S. immigration courts. We'll talk with the former head of a federal immigration agency about how the system got overwhelmed and what could help it get back on track. Now, workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, voted yesterday on whether to unionize. This is only the second time an effort to unionize Amazon workers in the U.S. has made it to a vote. Vote counting started this week. Amazon is the country's second largest employer, and this vote could have an impact that goes far beyond this or other Amazon warehouses, extending to the labor movement as a whole. We're talking now about the union vote at that warehouse and what it means for the whole country. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a current or former union member yourself? What did you see as the benefits, or did you see drawbacks? Do you think Amazon workers should unionize? What are you watching for in the outcome of this vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. John Shelton is an associate professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies in the UW-Green Bay Department of History. He's the author of Teacher Strike, Public Education and the Making of a New American Political Order. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. I'm really happy to be here.
How important do you see this particular Amazon warehouse unionization vote beyond the boundaries of that particular warehouse?
Yeah, you know, there's obviously been a ton of media attention around this the past few weeks with, you know, Amazon having the profile that it does. But I think no matter how much attention there's been, in some ways it's not enough. I mean, this is really a pretty important moment in the history of labor relations in this country. In particular, because we're at a moment where it's very difficult for unions to organize and win elections, and it's particularly so in the South. You know, in the South, there's a history of employers sort of playing white workers against black workers, and for a variety of other reasons, unions are weaker in the South than they are in other regions. So it's significant that it's there. But you know, labor law in this country really favors the employer, and one of the things that we've seen in this strike is Amazon. I'm sorry, this election, we're not dealing with a strike,
right.
Not yet. But one of the things that we've seen is Amazon really sort of pulling out all the stops that corporations have done, you know, really over the past 40 or 50 years to make it more difficult for workers to organize. So, you know, they're holding these meetings weekly where they're basically kind of explaining to workers why, you know, they shouldn't vote for the union. The union doesn't really have the same time to respond. So it's in the industry, they call these captive audience meetings. You know, they're sort of making implicit threats about what could happen if the workers form a union. I mean, there's a whole an industry that's emerged, you know, called the union avoidance industry. So it's kind of amazing that we're here. And if workers win this, you know, not only is this going to have a tremendous impact in Amazon, right, because, you know, there are warehouses across this country that this would provide a really positive model for, but it would really show, you know, a lot of other workers out there who want to join unions, and something like 48% of workers who are not in a union want one, you know, would show them that it's possible to win under these very difficult circumstances.
Now, Amazon has made the case to those workers and publicly that, hey, we pay $15 an hour, much better than a minimum wage job, benefits and things like that. I've seen others point to, warehouse logistics workers often get paid more than that. Amazon might be paying less by comparison. Can you talk about the argument over the costs and benefits for workers from unionizing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would really say two things about that. I mean, first of all, a $15 an hour wage is really kind of the minimum where things should be in this country, right? If the minimum wage had kept up with inflation, we'd be at, like, you know, way higher than $15 an hour. But I want to just put this into perspective for folks who are listening to this, right? A $15 an hour wage is $30,000 a year. Now, that in many places is not actually a living wage, right? And to put that into some perspective here, right, these workers are trying to organize. Their ultimate boss, right? I mean, until very recently, you know, CEO of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, made about $75 billion in 2020. And if you suss out that math, that means that he made in 2020 about $30,000 every 12 minutes. Okay, so those are sort of the stakes of this, and how this make us sort of look at the larger issue of wealth inequality and income inequality in this country. So that's number one, right? I mean, I think the workers would argue, as to your point, that they should be making more than $15 an hour. But the bigger principle at play here is something that labor scholars have talked about, and this was something that came up all the way back in the early 20th century, the idea of industrial democracy, the idea that to be treated as people and to have some say in your working conditions is just as important as having good wages. And that's a big part of this fight, actually. So some of the things that these workers are really sort of upset about is the larger conditions under which Amazon employees are working. They're the same as Amazon employees are working across the country. I mean, Amazon is, they pay $15 an hour. There's just all kinds of accounts of workers talking about what a grueling place it is, the amount of physical effort, being monitored every minute of the day. I mean, the number of people basically saying, who work at Amazon who are saying, like, we don't even have time to take a bathroom break. So the argument here is that workers need a union to effectively negotiate for those things, to negotiate for dignity and to really have a say in their workplace, and that's just as important as it is, to have a good wage.
Talking to John Shelton, Associate Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW Green Bay, about the unionization vote at an Amazon warehouse facility in Alabama, what it means for the rest of the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions on the issue. John, put this in the wider perspective for us. No secret, a big decline, right, in union membership in the United States over the last few decades.
Yeah. And so, again, I think, and I sort of led off with this, but I mean, I think the terrain in which these workers are trying to win this election is really important, because we have labor laws in this country that favor the employer. I mean, you look at, I cited, the number that, almost half of people who don't have a union want one. Two-thirds of Americans approve of unions right now. So it's not translating into, these sort of collective bargaining relationships. Only 6% of workers in the private sector have a collective bargaining relationship. You contrast that with Europe, where, in Germany, workers have, something like 60% of workers are covered by some kind of, collective negotiation. And excuse me. The reason for that is that we have labor law in this country that, really hasn't been reformed since its inception. I mean, the playing field in which workers are, even in Amazon, casting their ballots with this incredible effort, to try and convince them that they shouldn't organize. A lot of people who look at labor unions and the labor movement in this country say that that's not actually that democratic, right? I mean, it would be like having a political election where one side really didn't have, really couldn't play on the same field as the other side. And so, I think one of the things that's come out of this, and it's not a surprise that this conversation around Amazon is happening, where there's a big conversation about a major reform to labor law in this country. They're happening at the same time. So, a lot of your listeners probably know that there's a law called the PRO Act, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, that's actually passed the House, and it hasn't been taken up in the Senate yet. But there's a pretty robust conversation about passing a law like that would really help to sort of equal the playing field.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Black River Falls. Chris, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The union issue, I don't think we need unions anymore. We needed them in the past for safety issues and the conditions that were out there. We don't need them anymore. If people don't like working at Amazon, they can go someplace else. Let the free market take care of it. This is going to cost jobs. It's going to cost, things are going to be higher to ship, et cetera. We don't need unions.
Chris, thanks for the call. John?
Yeah, Chris, that's certainly one argument that you can make, and appreciate the argument. I would say a couple of things to that. I mean, number one, the idea that Amazon can't afford, to pay higher wages or ensure the safety of its workers when this is a corporation that rakes in billions of dollars in profits every year. I just don't think that's persuasive to most people. I mean, again, public opinion polling bears it out. And the other thing I would say is that, you could argue that maybe unions aren't necessary anymore, but I got to tell you, that's news to all of the Amazon workers who are talking about their working conditions there. I mean, when people can't take a bathroom break, you know, something's got to happen to sort of change that power dynamic. And, you know, again, it's possible to find another job somewhere else. But I think the bigger question is, what do we want our work lives to look like? I mean, do we want to basically walk into a situation? I mean, everybody has to work for a living. Do we want that situation to look like a dictatorship, or should workers have some say over their working conditions and some ability to ensure that they have dignity in the workplace? And I think, you know, whether the workers win or not, a very substantial portion of them are going to vote for the union. And I think they would disagree with Chris's point.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We're talking to John Shelton, Associate Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW Green Bay, talking about a union vote at an Amazon warehouse in Alabama and what it means for the labor movement in general. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been part of a unionization effort at a private company? How did it go? What do you think of unions? Do you think that Amazon warehouses should be unionized? What are you hoping comes out of this election? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with John Shelton, Associate Professor of History at UW Green Bay, looking at how the vote on whether to unionize an Amazon warehouse in Alabama could affect the future of the labor movement. Votes being counted this week in that unionization drive. You could join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Viroqua. Mike, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Mike?
I was just going to mention that I've held a union position, a job for 6 years. I've since quit that. But as far as bathroom breaks and working conditions, they were among some of the worst as far as places I've been employed through.
Mike, what line of work were you in a union shop for, if I may ask?
It was a construction job, so, you know, it's usually pretty rough and tumble. But just still being union, you know, you're almost dehumanized. At least I felt that way.
Mike, thanks for the call. John, Mike saying he didn't have a great experience in a union construction shop.
Yeah, Mike, I appreciate that comment. I mean, you know, working conditions vary where, you know, so much in different places across the country. I don't know the specifics of your union. I mean, you know, I think it's important for us to recognize that unions are not perfect, right? I mean, they're social organizations. And you know, it can sometimes be difficult for workers to advocate for the things that they want, but that's all the more reason for folks to get involved in their union if the union is not representing them and making sure they have the things that they need. I mean, to your point, every worker deserves to have dignity in the workplace, and I mean, something as basic as a bathroom break is not something that should be up for grabs.
I wanted to talk to you about the bathroom break issue, John, and how it plays out in this, or from what we've heard, at least from Amazon employees, it isn't you're barred from using the bathroom, right? It is there are productivity measurements that are hurt if you do something like use the bathroom. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. So what Amazon does with its workforce, and it, you know, it's we should be honest about the fact this is one of the reasons its profits are so astronomical is because they effectively have sped up their workforce so much. You know, there was a movement to do this called scientific management, and it started in the early 20th century. And the basic idea was to figure out how quickly you could push workers to work, you know, to get the maximum amount of productivity. And that's what Amazon is doing here. I mean, that's their corporate philosophy. It's by the way, it's not just people on the shop floor, you know, at these warehouses. It's also, you know, in the management positions. I mean, there are all these, you know, revelations of the kind of working conditions that everybody working at Amazon with this sort of like intense drive to make it as profitable as possible, putting all these people in positions where they're sort of overworked. And so that's exactly right. But it's worse for folks in the warehouse because every one of their movements are constantly measured. And if they're not meeting these productivity quotas, you know, they're disciplined or possibly fired. And so you have a lot of workers basically saying, like, I have to be really careful about doing this because if I take a break, you know, that's going to be some demerits against me. And I have to make sure that my productivity is constantly up. So people are working under tremendous pressure. That's been magnified over the past year. In particular, as Amazon has tried to get, with a much more virtual shopping world, get everything to consumers like right away, because consumers expect to have them right away. And, you know, the other part of this I would mention is that, 80% of these workers are African-American. I mean, these are, the folks who are feeling this intense level of scrutiny and stress are a large majority of Black workers. And in Amazon, they're connecting this to the larger sense of, economic and racial equality in this country. And, they're making that connection, pretty profoundly. And I think it's all the more interesting because, when you look at the numbers on this, unions tend to help African-Americans because they're at some of the lower echelon, disproportionately at the lower echelons of the labor force. And so unions help African-Americans in this sort of fight for better wages and dignity disproportionately than white workers. So it's really fascinating.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kurt is with us in Mauston. Kurt, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Just had a couple of experiences. I've worked both with the Teamsters and then also as a Teamster and then in later years as management in the state of Wisconsin and also in a private corporation. And just seeing it from all kind of perspectives, I've grown to appreciate and dislike unions. The union leadership has to be focused on supporting their members and not focused on supporting their management circle. And I think that's where the Wisconsin State Employees Union got in trouble. But then on the flip side, working for a private corporation, I work for a company that in my eyes would no doubt gut the workforce and take advantage of the employees every chance they could if they didn't have the union there to support and protect the employees. And that's all I've got.
Interesting. Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. Nuanced perspective there, John. What do you think?
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Kurt. And, once again, I think you're hitting on the point that unions are only as good as their members, right? I mean, unions are democracies. In some ways, they're maybe some of the most purest form of democracy we have in this country. And members have to push their leadership. And you're right. Like it can, the leadership that's in place can really vary. I can't comment on your particular situation at all, but I will just point out that, I have an uncle who was a Teamster trucker for a very long period of time. And he has a pension right now because of his union. So, I think there's a vast range of experiences out there.
Thanks for that call. Mike joins us next from Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Yes, I used to work for the Koch brothers, Koch Industries. As a manager, they spent a lot of effort on trying to basically convince us that unions were bad. We were instructed to find any way we could other than pay or benefits in order to motivate our employees. One of the things that we were taught was that basically that the unions set the threshold, the bottom level of the pay scale, and if we had similar workers, we had to pay a scale that was relatively similar to what they could get at a union job. So the people that don't belong to a union really benefit from the unions in that their pay is elevated in respect to that. So without the unions, from the previous caller, what he had to say, I agree, we would lose a lot of our protections, a lot of our benefits, and most certainly our pay across the board as workers would go down. I've worked for four billionaires now, and they're always trying to find ways other than pay and benefits to motivate work out of the employees.
Mike, thanks for that call. That one point he made, John, is there research on that unions at one place might end up driving up wages even at their competing or other area non-union workplaces?
Yeah, there absolutely is. The reason for that is because other workplaces, I mean, certainly they have to pay higher wages to be competitive. Back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, which was sort of like the high watermark of private sector unionization in this country, about 35% of non-farm employers were unionized at that time. A lot of employers, if they didn't want to have a union representing their workers, they would basically treat their workers better. So, I think what the previous caller is really sort of hinting at here is that unions are broadly beneficial for most workers, and that's one of the reasons that companies like Amazon, you know, don't want them because their ability to make astronomical profits is in large part connected to how much they can get out of their workers at the lowest price. And, you know, we have a situation in this country. I just want to say we have a situation in this country where this level of inequality and the level of degradation that a lot of working people feel, this is an epidemic. I mean, it's been exacerbated over the past year, and we've seen it because of this sort of, you know, conversation about essential workers. But the way people are being treated in the workplace is not sustainable. And so, you know, we're going to have to make some changes either through making it easier for workers to organize, or, you know, there's going to have to be some other way to make things better for people in the workplace. I think most workers, you know, would agree that having some way to organize and have their voice heard collectively is probably the best way of doing that. But you know, the situation we have with, people being demonized for asking for more than $15 an hour, at the same time that you have billionaires like literally raking in profits at the expense of working people, I think that's going to come to a resolution one way or another. So it's a very, very important political and economic question that we're dealing with right now, and the Amazon case shows that.
We'll leave it there, John. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome, and good luck with the rest of the show.
That was John Shelton, Associate Professor and Chair of Democracy and Justice Studies in the UW-Green Bay Department of History. He joined us for a look at a unionization vote at an Amazon warehouse in Alabama and what it means for the labor movement overall. Votes being counted this week at that Amazon facility. Still time to share your thoughts on the issue. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, a former immigration official joins us to talk about the challenges facing the U.S. asylum system and the growing number of unaccompanied kids arriving now at the U.S. southern border. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the economy is making a comeback. Jen White has a special report from Houston as the program hears from businesses and workers holding out for a full recovery. It's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, an increase in people seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border has led to overcrowded immigration facilities, a loosening of COVID-19 safety rules, and minors being held for longer than the legal standard of 72 hours. The latest increase in numbers for the country's asylum system, which currently has a backlog of more than 1 million cases waiting to be ruled on by immigration courts. Our next guest oversaw the last major reform of the asylum process. She says that streamlining it and working more closely with Central American countries can help get the system back on track. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the current situation at the border and about how claiming asylum works in the first place? Are there changes you would like to see? Does the answer lay in doing more to process claims or making it harder for people to arrive and make those claims in the first place? Have you or someone in your family been granted asylum? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Doris Meisner is a senior fellow and director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. She was commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service from 1993 to 2000. She's also a native of Wisconsin. Doris, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start with what's going on the border now, this increase in the number of minors, unaccompanied minors seeking asylum. What do you see driving those numbers right now?
Well, those numbers are being driven by a couple of things. Primarily, they're being driven by conditions in the countries that these young people are coming from. Those countries are primarily Honduras and Guatemala, but also El Salvador, the Northern Triangle countries, as they're known, of Central America. Those are countries that have have very poor economic prospects, but they also are, for these young people, very dangerous places to grow up because of gangs and cartel violence and young people, particularly young men, being recruited into the gang life as they become teenagers. But these are countries also that suffered two back-to-back very destructive hurricanes in November that decimated large areas of the country and destroyed livelihoods and homes. And there are also countries, Guatemala in particular, where climate change has begun to really create drought conditions that's intensified hunger in the country and has made coffee, which is one of the main agricultural products that have succeeded in Guatemala, has made the coffee crop really suffer. So there are a host of reasons, but of course they're also combined with the fact that many people in those countries have connections in the United States. They have family members in the United States or people from communities that they grew up in who are in the United States. And so the tradition of coming north is one that then becomes an option when you have those very difficult conditions in the home countries.
And we've just had a change of presidential administration, definitely at least in the way that President Biden has framed the issue, definitely different than President Trump. Some people have said that's been seen as an invitation for people to seek to cross the border now as opposed to, say, last year. Is there anything to that?
Well, of course, last year was the COVID. Well, it still is the COVID year, but last year is the year that the COVID restrictions went into place on the southwest border, on the U.S.-Mexico border, and that it's referred to as the CDC order, which required all people to be expelled, and which also extended into Mexico and these Northern Triangle countries. So there was very little movement anywhere in the hemisphere last year. The year prior to that, of course, 2019, was one of the peak years of migration, particularly, again, of young people from Central America. So it was halted for a while by the pandemic. But these numbers were increasing beginning last fall, and it was quite clear that the numbers were going up gradually. There then was a court injunction that prevented the United States from expelling people into Mexico. So numbers really increased in October and in November. And then at the end of January, when that court action was lifted and the government was allowed again to return people, young people, to Mexico, the Biden administration decided that where minors were concerned, it was simply as a matter of pure humanity, not responsible and not humane to return people who are minors back to Mexico. But it maintained the return of all other groups of migrants that those expulsions under the public health order have continued to Mexico. So, yes, the policy did change at the end of January under President Biden, where minors are concerned, but the signs of the buildup had been happening for months before that time.
Talking to Doris Meisner from the Migration Policy Institute, former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, looking at the latest news from the border and long-term solutions. And Doris, before we get into some long-term solutions you're looking for, right now that decision to not send kids into Mexico is creating this logistical crisis, I think is a fair word, where these kids are going to stay. Do you have thoughts on short-term solutions to that immediate problem?
Well, yes, I think that it is the case that the Biden administration just coming into office did know and did expect that the numbers would go up because they were going up already. But I don't think anybody expected that they would increase so quickly within just a few weeks, because these really are unprecedented levels for January and February. January and February typically in prior years have not been as, you know, the numbers have not been as large as they have been over the last 2 months. So the difficulty, of course, is, as you say, the logistics of preparedness. And the preparedness is complicated by COVID because facilities for holding people have been have dropped because of space and staff considerations. But it's also true that now there is a very serious problem of throughput. In other words, the facilities available that are shelters and appropriate for young people are in shorter supply than the numbers that are coming into the hands of the Border Patrol. And so there's this backup where people are being held in Border Patrol facilities that are simply not suited for any kind of longer term stay, and certainly not suited for young people. You know, the basic pattern at the Southwest border for which the Border Patrol's facilities have been designed are turnaround. I mean, people stay in Border Patrol custody for just a few hours or overnight, and typically then are returned to their country or to Mexico. That's not the case where minors are concerned, because minors have a different, they're under a different legal structure, and they are permitted to have their cases heard by asylum officers. But in order for that to happen, they are, whenever possible, released into the care of relatives in the United States or other sponsors. You know, it's a very telling number. These young people that are coming across now, 80% of them have a relative in the United States. And half of those relatives that are in the United States are either one or both parents, which goes to the bigger issue of how outdated and ill-suited our immigration laws are to the circumstances of the migration that's taking place today. If we had updated immigration laws in ways actually that this administration is proposing, we would have a situation where the people who are already in the United States but have been here for so many years illegally would have an opportunity to legalize their status, and they would then be able to petition for their relatives to come to the U.S. legally. But that doesn't exist, nor do we have the kinds of access to the United States for jobs for people who want to work, who could make useful contributions in our economy, that would make it possible for people in countries like Central America to get a visa to come to the United States for work purposes. So all of those things together create this situation where the asylum system is the only access or the only avenue. Unfortunately, most of these people will not be eligible for asylum even when their claims are heard, because the asylum definition is a strict one. You have to be able to show the likelihood of suffering persecution for reasons of race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or membership in a social group. Those are the five grounds, as they're known. And even though the people coming from Central America, both the minors as well as adults and families, are escaping dreadful circumstances, that doesn't automatically translate into their being eligible for asylum under the legal definitions for asylum.
We're talking to Doris Meisner, senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, former head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, about the challenges facing the country's asylum system and what to do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what we're seeing at the southern border and how the asylum system works? What kind of solutions would you like to see? What questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Doris Meisner, former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, looking at the country's asylum system and how we can maybe rethink it to meet the current demand at the southern border. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. We'll go to your calls now. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Hi. I just have a question about the quota system. There are people all around the world that need asylum. There are people in the inner city of Milwaukee that need to run away from violence and whatnot. Letting all these people in from Latin America just because they're closer to us than, let's say, a refugees from Yemen or from Libya or from Iraq or Syria, like, we don't hear anything about saving any of those people, but just because you are able to walk to our border now, we're letting in all these people from Latin America. Does that mean that fewer people can come from these other countries, which are in far worse shape than Latin America?
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. Doris, that's asylum versus the refugee system. Two different, as I understand it, channels of immigration. But is there something to what Ray's saying? More people coming in from Central America means fewer opportunities for people elsewhere in the world.
Well, actually, no, it is not a direct trade-off at all. These are two separate streams or two separate methods of humanitarian protection that the U.S. provides. Now, where the refugee program is concerned and countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and I certainly agree with the caller that the needs in those parts of the world and many other areas are acute as well. The refugee program and refugee resettlement that the United States does was, of course, during the last 4 years, severely reduced. I mean, the U.S. has been one of the biggest refugee resettlement countries in the world, but over the last 4 years, those numbers were reduced to less than about 15,000. The Biden administration has committed to ramping up refugee admissions from abroad. It is targeting 125,000 refugees a year. That probably won't be the case this year because it takes some time to ramp back up to that number. But the role that the United States plays in overseas refugee admissions will resume after the break that we've had, as I said, in the last couple of years. But that is a parallel track to people seeking asylum when they already have gotten to the United States. However, it is absolutely the case that walking to the United States should not be something that we see in our hemisphere. It should not be something that would be acceptable to us, particularly in the case of highly vulnerable people like young people and families with young children, whether or not they are ultimately eligible for asylum. We should have what's generally thought of as safe, legal, and orderly immigration procedures. And that, of course, is one of the longer-term proposals that the Biden administration is making, which is to say that the Biden administration is looking to provide opportunities for people to apply for asylum from the countries of Latin America, just as one would from Syria or from Iraq, so that if there were refugee admissions and the opportunity for people who truly are fleeing life-threatening dangers to get protection closer to their homes, either from processing within the countries, which has been done in the past and this administration is seeking to reactivate, as well as by neighboring countries, Costa Rica, Panama, we should have a regional system where not only the United States, but also Canada, Mexico, other countries participate. Now, there is some recent news that the discussions between the United States and Mexico along those lines might also bring about other places for people who are fleeing the Northern Triangle countries and have legitimate claims to get help. The Mexican definition for asylum is a less stringent one than the U.S. definition, and Mexico is also a country that will begin to have opportunities because of changes in its demographics for people to come from neighboring countries for work purposes. So one would also want to see Mexico being a participant as the next near country in providing protection, as well as having a healthy immigration program for employment-based immigration, just as we should be having in the United States.
And Doris, part of this involves clearly cooperation with the countries of origin here, the three Northern Central American countries you referenced. Do we have willing and able partners in those governments, given the circumstances in their countries that are already driving people to want to leave?
Not entirely. I mean, the aid and assistance programs that the Biden administration is talking about will largely go through community and non-governmental groups rather than the governments. These are governments that are really beset by corruption and issues of citizen safety, so they are not the most amenable governments to work with. On the other hand, they are struggling democracies, and there are forces within those countries that are committed to the rule of law and are committed to reform. And what we need to be doing, and in what the Biden administration, I believe, intends to do over the longer term, is engage the sectors of those societies, civil society sectors, as well as certain parts of the business community, to really invest in and create opportunities in those countries. Those are longer-term endeavors, and they will take a real combination of carrots and sticks, which I believe we'll see more of, but those are the kinds of efforts that need to begin to kick in order to change the conditions that are creating these migrations.
Another piece of the puzzle, Doris, I want to talk about before we run out of time. We came into this year, I understand, with about a million case backlog in the asylum system. What do you see needing to be done to expedite things, move things along faster? And so that means for that asylum seeker, they might be accepted in the United States faster, or they might get a resolution that says no a lot faster. Either way, I think people would like to see both of those outcomes happen in a more timely way.
Yes, I completely agree with that. We have a system that is broken with that kind of a backlog. The fact that it takes years for people to get their decisions contributes to the reasons that people come to the United States. So we need to be making asylum decisions within months, not within years. And I think we will probably see some change where that's concerned. I hope we see some change where that's concerned in this administration as well. We could be making those decisions by asylum officers rather than by immigration judges. Asylum officers are highly trained, and they make similar decisions for asylum cases that arise in other parts of the country. It's a quirk in our law that people who come across the southern border are to see an immigration judge, but that could be changed with a regulation. So another goal that's extremely important is an asylum decision system, hopefully using very well-trained asylum officers to make decisions within a few months. And then, as you say, those who are deserving of protection will get it and can be on their way. Those who are not, and unfortunately it likely is to be the majority, will need to be returned to their countries and hopefully connected with some greater degree of support services in those countries through the broader assistance that the United States and others would be giving to help those countries to succeed as countries.
And very briefly, Doris, that streamlining process, can a president do that, or does Congress need to be involved?
A president can do that through the regulatory press, through publishing regulations.
Doris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Nice to talk to you.
You too. That's Doris Meisner, senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. She served as commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service from 1993 to 2000. She's also from Wisconsin. She joined us to look at the demand facing the country's asylum system and what changes could help it start working through a big backlog of cases. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 8, from personal computers to global networks, cyber attacks are a big problem and the world is hustling to keep up. Take a tour of the cutting edge of cyber security with the author of the new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the U.S. Postal Service is proposing a 10-year plan that could save billions of dollars but reduce some services. Talk with a reporter on the post office beat about the plan and the reaction it's getting in Congress. And you can join an ongoing conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page with your reaction to a proposal from Facebook, an idea in the works for Instagram for kids 12 and under. Good idea, bad idea, what concerns do you have, what hopes would you have for that, and how do you handle social media issues in your family? Let us know what you think over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.